This week on Making Contact.
What prisons are, I think, actually in the world, are machines for human sacrifice. They destroy the people who are held there. They destroy the communities where prisoners come from, and they destroy the places where the prisons are built.
More than 2 million people in the United States live behind prison bars. In the state of California alone, there are more people locked up than in prisons in France, Germany, the Netherlands, and Singapore combined. Dr. Ruth Gilmore is a key figure in the grassroots movement fighting prison expansion in California. On this edition, she extracts lessons from more than two decades of on-the-ground community organizing against what's been termed the biggest prison building project in the history of the world. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Dr. Ruth Gilmore is a prison activist at its core. A current University of Southern California geography professor, Dr. Gilmore has spent more than two decades studying, critiquing, and speaking out against California's criminal justice system. In fact, she's one of the founding members of Critical Resistance, a social justice organization working to end society's reliance on prisons and policing. Dr. Gilmore just released her new book, Golden Gulag: Prisons, Surplus, Crisis, and Opposition in Globalizing California. Critical Resistance hosted a launch party for her at the Uptown Body and Fender Shop in Oakland, California. This is an excerpt from that speech.
A lot of people who've read my book so far, or have kind of glanced at it with horror, have said, Ruthie, why do we have to slog through all this stuff? Can't we just throw our fists in the air and say the system is evil? Tear it down. Well, we can, but so what? If we throw our fists in the air and just say the system is evil, tear it down, we will have perhaps spoken to each other and maybe one or two other people. Even though it feels great, and maybe at the end of my talk we should all just, you know, throw it. Well, let's just do it now. The system is evil, tear it down!
Tear it down!
That's better. Okay, now that we've done that. We've done that, but having said that, then we say, where are we going to put this fist, right? Where are we going to put this fist? And if to decide where to put the fist, we've got to put our brains first. So first I'm going to read to you from the beginning of my book. This is my road tour copy. And this is the prologue. This is called The Bus. One midnight in the middle of April, late in the 20th century, a bus pulled out of the Holman Methodist Church parking lot. Traveling a short way along the northern boundary of South Central Los Angeles, it geared up a ramp into the web of state and federal highways that connect California's diverse industrial, agricultural, and recreational landscapes into the fifth largest economy in the world. On the bus, 40 women, men, and children settled in for the seven-hour journey north to Sacramento and the state capital. A dream crowd rode for freedom. Red, black, brown, yellow, and white. Mothers, fathers, grandparents, sisters, brothers, children, lovers, and friends. Gay men and lesbians. Interracial families. English, Spanish, Tagalog, Arabic, Polish, and Hebrew speakers. Catholic, Protestant, Jew, Muslim, Eastern Orthodox, and Quaker. And this was 40 people. So some of their characteristics. Their diversity embodied some 150 years of California history and more than 300 years of national anxieties and antagonisms. But the riders didn't worry about it. They got on the bus because of their sameness. Employed, disabled, or retired working people with little or no discretionary income, whose goal was freedom for their relatives serving long sentences behind bars. The dream riders were summoned by a nightmare, made palpable by the terrifying numbers of prisoners in prisons produced during the past generation, while we were all presumably awake. Just as real was the growing grassroots activism against the expanded use of criminalization and cages as catch-all solutions to social problems. In order to realize their dream of justice in individual cases, the riders decided, through struggle, debate, failure, and renewal, that they must seek general freedom for all, from a system in which punishment has become as industrialized as making cars, clothes, or missiles, or growing cotton. Against the odds, they'd come to activism, acting out in the details of modest practices the belief that we shall overcome the deep division so taken for granted in apartheid America. In other words, they shared more than an interest. Purpose made them ride. Some snoozed, some played cards. Some talked about who would join them on the State House steps, who would sit with them in the Senate Committee on Public Safety hearing room, and what best strategy would persuade a prisoner-hostile legislative committee majority to amend California's three strikes law. Some watched through the window with an intensity suggesting that the night might reveal an answer. Instead, what they saw were the landscapes of labor, living, and leisure stretching out to the horizon. Leaving Los Angeles, the bus traveled up the broad old industrial corridor's central artery. Although the city is still the manufacturing capital of the United States, the mix and remuneration of jobs making things has changed drastically in the past 20 years. Auto and primary steel are mostly gone, replaced by apparel and rebar. On Interstate 5, the great road over the Tehachapi Mountains, the bus passed endless residential developments and signs touting business-friendly regions in the northern reaches of Los Angeles County before slipping into the darkness of the Angeles National Forest. The federal interstates enabled suburbanization of both residents and industry and helped secure California's historical dominance in the military-industrial complex. Indeed, for most of the families on the bus, overt wars, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, and covert wars, Jim Crow, Mississippi, and Louisiana, were the forces that had pushed and pulled them to Southern California to remake their lives, as long-distance migrants must. Rolling down the long grade into the great Central Valley, some of the riders speculated about the gargantuan pumping stations that propel water gathered from the state's northern and eastern regions over the mountains to quench the Southland's thirst. And yet, although the water courses up out of the valley, a lot remains to irrigate the state's agricultural immensity. Indeed, while agriculture is only 3% of the gross state product, California ranks first in the United States in agricultural production. They stopped in Bakersfield to pick up more people, a farm worker, an unemployed journalist, some prisoners' mothers taking an unpaid day off work and contributing from their slim wages toward the $1,000 charter cost. Outside Bakersfield, darkness drew in again around the Thomas-built coach. A small group of riders sitting in the back started to count sightings of intensely golden glows that eerily poked depth into the flat blackness. These concentrations of light in farmland are many of California's new prisons, cities of men and sometimes women that lie next to the dim towns that host them. Some passengers whispered, their words recorded as breath on glass, "Donnie's over there. Hello, Richard. I wonder if on hell is asleep. I told him we'd pass by." The small fogs cleared as the bus labored on. Other buses make this journey every day from central Los Angeles, leaving not from churches, but rather from courts and jails. Their destinations are the old and new prisons, those that cluster along Highway 99 and make it a prison alley, and others further afield, from the sturdy perimeter of fortresses along the California-Mexico border in the south, up into Indian country at Susanville and Crescent City at the Oregon line. 900 miles of prisons, an archipelago of concrete and steel cages, 33 major prisons, plus 57 smaller prisons and camps, 43 of the total built since 1984. Arriving in Sacramento, the riders joined their allies from other parts of the state for a prayer breakfast and a rally on the Capitol steps. Then the day's principal activity began, the long committee session. They would try again to persuade people eager for re-election who review and approve new criminal laws 3 hours a week, every week, to undo part of one law, even while a major campaign contributor, the Prison Guards Union, summoned its lobbyist brigades to denounce any reform. For a moment, before the group moved indoors, the ordinarily gray-white state buildings yellowed to reflect the warming sunshine, a sensation welcomed by a few aching elderly passengers always alert for signs of hope. Perhaps on this trip, they might knock one block out of the Golden Gulag's miles and miles of prison walls. And then I end the book with an epilogue, which I don't know if this is bad or not, but I'm going to read you the end of the book. So you're going to know what happens. You won't want to see the movie. Okay, this is called Another Bus. This is called Another Bus. In 2001, a group of people boarded another bus in South Central Los Angeles, this time bound for Fresno, and a conference called Joining Forces, the fight for environmental justice and against prisons. Fewer people rode this time, but their determination was no less fierce. They were headed to the second small conference in California, bringing together rural people trying to stop the building of prisons and urban activists trying to stop the production of prisoners. Meeting was not easy because for quite some time, each group imagined that the other, in a general way, was the reason for its struggles. City people presumed everyone in rural towns wanted prisons, and rural activists feared that nobody in urban centers was trying to get at the root causes sending so many people to prison. The recognition that forged solidarity between unlikely allies from Farmersville and Los Angeles was not spontaneous. If only. However, something like magic seemed to happen. At the conference, activists talked about how their organizations identified problems, shaped good questions, searched for causes, and embarked, often in fits and starts, on courses of action. Juana Gutierrez, the founder of Mothers of East Los Angeles, a group that stopped Sacramento from building a prison in their neighborhood, describe how she and the other, quote, crazy women she worked with started to raise questions about why so many people presumed their kids would wind up in prison. Gutierrez laid out the scenario, identifying what technocrats would call risk factors, and paused at each one to raise a question about the problem. School, for example. Kids who miss a lot of school generally do not graduate, and young people without high school diplomas are more likely than those with credentials to wind up in cages. She and her friends asked why their kids were more likely to miss school, and through observation, arrived at a cause. They were sick a lot. What kind of illness? Asthma. Why would kids in East Los Angeles have higher than normal rates of asthma? In other words, why is asthma a disease of the poor? Their reasoning took them further, and in studying about the breathing disorder, they discovered that restricted airway disease is caused by certain environmental contaminants, toxic substances that are common in their area, which abuts on Los Angeles' mini steel mill district, where they make rebar. Farm workers, prisoners' families, immigrant rights activists, environmental justice organizers, and prison abolitionists all recognized in Gutierrez's argument some fundamental practices and welcome truths. As Gutierrez showed, urban and rural households struggle from objectively similar but subjectively different positions across the prison landscape. They can and will join forces when the purpose is a common one and the issue is not just local. Most of those fighting in the trenches have little time for activism motivated solely by abstract political or ethical rhetoric. Rather, they are fighting for their lives, their families, and their communities. The remedy for cumulative negative impacts must be bigger and more compelling than a simple technocratic fix. A principled sense of mortal urgency gets grassroots activists to go to meetings, makes them board buses, and inspires hope. Perhaps this is what class politics should be, in contradiction to the Golden Gulag's prison-lit but starless night. So now you know how it ends. The last thing that I read to you told you in two sentences that a group of women in East Los Angeles stopped the state of California from building a prison in their neighborhood. And East LA is the historical heart of Chicano Mexicano Los Angeles. The state had decided in 1983 that it was going to build all the new prisons that they planned to build, and they planned to build a lot of them, in Los Angeles and further south, so south of the Tehachapis. But after this group of women stopped them dead in their tracks. They rethought. And they decided that they didn't want to go through battle after battle and have people in communities that have a history and an expectation of successfully doing political struggle, right, especially over conditions in their community. They didn't want to face that anymore. So they tried to figure out, the legislature tried to figure out how to wiggle out of their own ruling. So they decided what they'd do was shelve the Los Angeles prison and never appropriate money for it, never vote money for it, and then start building other prisons. And then they just kind of forgot that they were going to build them all in the Southland and started building them everywhere else.
You've been listening to Dr. Ruth Gilmore. Coming up next.
The prison system itself just needs to be abolished because it's not working.
And we'll hear more from Dr. Ruth Gilmore. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. For more information, or for a CD copy of this program, please call 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. In April 2007, California state legislators passed AB 900, a law authorizing the construction of 53,000 new jail and prison cells in California. It's the largest single prison building project in the world, and it will cost taxpayers $15 billion. There were no public hearings on this bill, and although AB 900 is often touted as prison reform, Dr. Gilmore and other prison activists say it's just plain old prison expansion.
So what should we do about the governor's plan? And the answer is fight, 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 fight. And I just had a little bit of a debate over at Bolt Law School today up at Berkeley with a law student who, with the best of intentions, proposed, maybe just for the sake of discussion, I don't know what she believes, but she proposed that what we should do is yield on some of this prison expansion in exchange for trying to bargain for sentencing reform. She proposed that if we don't give them what they want, which will also, she proposed, help people who are currently in prison because they'll be in better situations, we won't get what we want. Now, as I recall, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. This is insane to say, okay, if they build one or two or three or 78,000 new beds, that somehow the people who are in custody are going to be in a better situation than they are now. It's only ever going to be a nightmare. It can't, the way I put it, you can't tweak Armageddon. That's in the 10 Theses. You can't, you cannot, Armageddon is not tweakable, right? And allowing, you know, some prison expansion in exchange for what? I mean, what on earth would our bargaining power be? Right? Essentially, what that position asks us to do is to embrace prisons. And what prisons are in the United States of America, and what prisons are, I think, actually in the world, are machines for human sacrifice. They destroy the people who are held there against their will. They are not good for the people who work there, however much they might think they're working there of their own free will. They destroy the communities where prisoners come from, and they destroy the places where the prisons are built. They are machines of human sacrifice. So yielding and saying, well, we will go along with a little more human sacrifice in order to slow down human sacrifice is insane. It really is. Now, let me say one more thing. One of the ways, the kind of the thin wedge at the front of the governor's proposal to expand the capacity of the state's adult system by 78,000 beds is one that is supposed to be, well, it comes under the label gender-responsive corrections. And what that means is they're going to build 4,500 new beds to put 4,500 people who are currently in women's prisons in. Except for they won't put the people who are currently in women's prisons in them, because by the time they build them, the people who would be eligible to move to the 4,500 cozy new beds will be out, so it'll be some other 4,500 women. But the point is, it's not as though the current women's prisons, the two in Chowchilla and the one at, in Chino down south, will have 4,500 fewer people in them. They will be as full as they are now. And there'll be 4,500 more women in prison, or more people in these prisons. Now, the way in which these prisons came forward on the agenda, as I said, came from under the behind a veil of gender-responsive corrections that a lot of people were fighting for, because the general model for prison is a military model. What you have coming in the door is an 18-year-old healthy male, and you do everything that you would do to keep an 18-year-old healthy male against his will. Most of the men who are in prison are not healthy, whatever their age, and most of the people who are in women's prison are not men, and they're not healthy, whether or not they're 18. Therefore, the people who were advocating on behalf of people in women's prisons said there's got to be a different strategy for holding people in cages in these particular kinds of facilities. That turned into, for a moment, a lot of serious talk about decarcerating 4,500 women, and that plan to decarcerate them, to get them out of prison and send them home, suddenly turned into a plan to build these new prisons, and the only thing that's not a prison about these prisons is their name. Just as the community correctional facilities they built about 10 or 12 years ago all over the state are prisons in everything but name. And if you doubt me, drive up Highway 99 to McFarland and just pull over by the side of the freeway and look at them. There's a row of them right there.
You've just heard from Dr. Ruth Gilmore speaking at the Uptown Auto Body and Fender Shop in Oakland, California. There's a growing movement comprised of former prisoners, community residents, labor organizers, and youth activists. They've been fighting against prison expansion and human rights abuses that occur inside prisons. Making Contact's Puck Low reports.
On May 23, 2007, Khalid Anur spoke outside the California State Building in Oakland, California, at a protest organized by Californians United for a Responsible Budget, CURB, a statewide coalition of more than 40 organizations committed to curbing prison spending by closing prisons.
What are they doing now? They're putting three beds to a cell. And I can tell you from experience, there's three men in a cell now. And what that does, that violates your space, because each inmate is allowed a certain amount of space in a room. If you're in a 12 by 12 box, you can't put three inmates in no one cell. It's unjust as far as the living condition. So they putting these extra beds. A lot of these extra beds are extra bunks. The third bunk be so high that you have to climb a ladder to get up. And it's just ridiculous because it's sort of like a death trap.
Another community response event was held on July 29th, 2007. I Scream Against Prison Expansion was a picnic and teach-in at a park in Oakland, California, which brought together community activists, musicians from Cove Records, and neighborhood residents to eat ice cream and debate the flaws that exist in the punishment system. The event was organized by Critical Resistance, a group fighting prison expansion.
Every weekend there's a funeral of an individual who died through the acts of violence. It's getting critical for strikes that are invisible. And the hood, it does get rough. And why I kill just to prove that you're tough.
I spoke with organizer Vanessa Huang from Justice Now, a group that works with women prisoners, about the California Department of Corrections' new Gender-Responsive Strategies Commission.
Right now we're fighting a really dangerous national policy trend where states are pushing for more prisons dressing them as what they call community-based alternatives or gender-responsive prisons. Here in California, they're calling them female rehabilitative community correctional centers. What we've seen, you know, the facilities that they're talking about are clearly prisons.
Huang and other activists criticized the California Department of Corrections' new gender-responsive language as an appropriation of feminist ideas. The department may be using feminist-sounding terms, but advocates say imprisonment only ultimately harms women and gender nonconforming people. Ms. Major works for the Trans in Prison Committee of the Transgender Intersex Justice Project. The group works to challenge and end the human rights abuses committed against gender variant, genderqueer, and intersex people in California prisons and beyond.
One of the stats from surveys and stuff that have been done is 59% of transgender women who've gone in any kind of jail or prison have been raped or assaulted. So for us, this is a regular occurrence. The prison system itself just needs to be abolished because it's not working. Look at all the people who go in there, come out, and go back. The recidivism rate is really, really high, not just for transgender people. They need to put their money toward education, toward housing, toward trainings, because if people have legitimate jobs and stuff like that, they don't have to do any criminal activity to feed themselves or to make sure that they have a change of clothes, you know?
But the education system, as it currently exists, does not challenge the state's use of prisons as a tool to solve all social problems, according to Zachary Norris. He works with Books Not Bars, a group that fights to redirect California's resources away from youth imprisonment and toward youth opportunities.
Our name is Books Not Bars, but we're not for any kind of education. If you look at community college instruction in the 1980s, a lot of it was geared towards training prison officers. So people were coming out with vocational training to be prison guards, but what we don't want is half of our community watching the other half, and both of those sides of the prison wall are suffering. Prison guards have some of the highest rates of domestic violence in families, and we know the impact on prisoners' families. And so what we need is a complete transformation of our society where we're gearing our society towards enterprises that are sustainable for all of our communities.
Former prisoners and activists co-authored a report entitled How Gender-Responsive Prisons Harm Women, Children, and Families. The report, released in April 2007, tackles the problems of overcrowding and abuses in women's prisons and makes several recommendations. Releasing 4,500 women from prison and providing 6 months of free housing to former prisoners re-entering society. They also propose closing down at least one prison within the next 2 years and reapportioning funds from prison construction and operation to fund job and skills trainings, as well as community health care. Californians United for a Responsible Budget will be organizing community members to attend California Department of Corrections meetings to show opposition to the implementation of AB 900. They encourage community organizations and unions to join with CURB to stop prison expansion. For Making Contact, this is Puck Lowe in Oakland, California.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to Dan Turner and the Monday Morning Breakfast crew. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a CD copy of program number 3407, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Puck Lowe associate producer, Samson Rainey and Joaquin Palomino interns, and I'm senior producer Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.